Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Welcome to the fifth of six installments of our special year-end awards. We'll give our final awards on Monday, January 2nd. So this is our final podcast for 2016 officially. And today we've got the prestigious categories of most overreported story, most underreported story, and best story of 2016. And if you've been with us throughout this week, you know we haven't exactly had the nicest things to say about the mainstream media throughout 2016, mostly on a political level, but in other areas as well. So today we're obviously going to be spending a lot of time talking about the press. So Jim, let's begin with most overreported story of 2016.
Well, Greg, I was very tempted to go with hate crimes since so many of them turn out to be hoaxes. But I'm actually going to go with one I think is central to the political narrative of 2016. And it's one that I think I overreported, or that I let influence my thinking on the election too much. Hillary Clinton's ground game and all those state offices she was opening up in swing state after swing state, you know, that Trump would have two in Ohio and she had 30 some, and she opened 40 some in Pennsylvania, you know, in Iowa, and in state after state, the word was she had more volunteers, more people knocking on more doors, more people making phone calls, a better data gathering operation, you name it, she had it better than Trump did. And we now know it didn't count for all that much. You can open a million and one local offices, but if your candidate is not all that appealing, it's not going to do that much good. And I went back and found probably the classic of this. This is from the first week of November over in Politico. Politico asked its own caucus, I'm making air quotes, it is, activists, strategists, and operatives in 11 swing states who are seeing significant early and absentee voting operations. More than three quarters of Democrats think their party has done a better job turning out key voters just so far. Democratic insiders are most confident in Colorado. Okay, give them credit for that. Nevada. Okay, they won that one. North Carolina. Uh-oh. Ohio.
Really?
And Wisconsin. They express more certainty in Florida and Iowa. Uncertainty in those two states. In the end, Hillary Clinton did not have the better campaign operation. A couple of weeks ago, you and I talked about how her campaign told a bunch of labor union activists, do not go to Michigan. We have that state locked down. It's fine. Spend your time in Iowa because we want to tie down the Trump campaign and make them spend time and resources there. Clearly, it turned out to be a big nothing, and way too many reporters, myself included, bought into this narrative that Clinton was duplicating what Barack Obama did in 2008 and 2012. And it's really interesting that Democrats had a system that seemed to work for them with admittedly a different, I think glaringly, obviously better candidate in those two cycles that they could not replicate this cycle.
Very good choice. Very good choice. Yeah, we kept hearing from the experts that there was no way Trump could compete given the infrastructure that Hillary had. But then as we found out after the election, Hillary wasn't necessarily using that infrastructure as effectively as she probably should have or could have. So excellent choice there. And all those who know better had some egg on their face for sure. Mine's going to be more broad. It's just all things Trump. The media couldn't get enough of him. And I guess I'm focusing primarily, at least in the first part of this response, in the primary. They decided early on, I guess, that even though he was doing well in the polls, there's no way he's actually going to win. But this guy is gold for our ratings. So we're just going to cover his rallies wire to wire. And maybe give a little bit of airtime to the other candidates. But when you look at the amount of free airtime that Trump got, it just dwarfs everybody else, possibly combined, as the primary season unfolded. And while the media was rubbing their hands with glee about the ratings and maybe some ad revenue and the fact that they were maybe even helping to make Trump the Republican nominee, it, of course, all blew up in their faces when he actually won the election, which is what they did not want. The other part of this is how the media made a habit of covering the things about Trump that didn't matter. And Trump, of course, played into that with some of his outrageous tweets and things he would do. But the media just loved the tabloid aspect of this campaign so much, whether it was Alicia Machado or the fight with the Gold Star father or anything else. Megyn Kelly.
Right? It was all personal, right?
Right. There was so little coverage of specific issues, with the exception of maybe when Trump was talking about the temporary ban on Muslim immigration, they got on that. But for the most part, this was a tabloid-style campaign, just explaining why Trump was a horrible human being from time to time, why they thought Hillary was fantastic. And they tried to make it about personality instead of about policy. And ultimately, it didn't work. The voters got sick of it, perhaps. Perhaps all of the negative Trump stories eventually, as we talked about earlier this week, eventually just led some voters to say, you know, nothing this guy's going to do is ever going to make anybody happy. And they decided to give him a shot. We don't know exactly how the media played into the final vote, but their handling of this campaign, we talked about their complete shredding of objectivity in this campaign, but what they chose to talk about was really, really poor as well. And the time allotment during the primary was just absurd.
A really good example of that, Greg, I salute you. It's a great pick. And I just want to observe that a couple weeks ago, I looked at the New York Times editorial page and the Washington Post editorial page, and basically every single op-ed tied back to Trump in some way. And I know it will stun you, Greg, that all of them are negative. And I just looked at this. You know, listeners to our podcast know I'm not the biggest fan of Trump in the world. In fact, I've been pretty darn critical. But even I found it tiresome, right? It was just this relentless drumbeat. And I have a feeling that mitigated their impact this year. So I think that's a good point. If you are constantly, you know, hammering the same message over and over again, people tune it out. And that may be a big part of what happened in 2016.
Yeah, you mentioned those editorials. You made a comment when you wrote about that saying, if everybody's the worst, then nobody's the worst. And it kind of goes back to the campaign. If everything's an outrage, then nothing's an outrage. And people eventually just tuned it out, I think. At least enough of them did to elect him president. So, Jim, on to the most underreported story of 2016.
So this was the kind of story that was glaringly obvious after, say, the first week of November, but was not clear up until then. It's not merely Trump's victory. I'm going to come up with the all-around broad-based backlash against political correctness. And I'll give you like one really good example. We did see coverage, for example, of the National Football League television ratings sliding for almost the entire year. There was a little bit of a resurgence towards the end of the year. For the first couple of months, particularly during the election, it really was down significantly. But what no one noticed other than one article in Sports Illustrated is the ratings for college football remain the same. So from that, you can actually toss out a lot of the theories outside of politics that were tossed out for this. Oh, you know, it's people are disturbed by the concussions, or oh, people think the commercial breaks are too long, or ah, there's too many games. No, no. Clearly, it's something unique to the NFL that was causing people to tune it out. Kaepernick. So you've got the NFL ratings slide. You had the Ghostbusters reboot with it was suddenly turned into this feminist film icon flopped. You and I have talked about enrollment down sharply at the University of Missouri. There was that like 2-day crusade against the hosts of Fixer Upper on HDTV. This was the year of the backlash against political correctness. And I think why I say this is an underreported story of the year is that it didn't happen overnight. This was building, you know, online outrage by online outrage, year by year, month by month, and it blindsided most of the media. Political correctness is never popular. It's never been popular. But you would never know that from the way the media talks about these issues. You would never know that almost half the country doesn't think gay marriage is a good idea. You would never know that most people think there are only two genders, right? And so you have this mentality that is completely alien to the, you know, the Acela Corridor crowd, but that is a good chunk of the heartland and represents, you know, half the country. You know, it's certainly not a small fringe minority. And so I kind of think a big story of 2016 was that political correctness is this strange, angry, humorless, all-encompassing, borderline Stalinist ideology that is thriving on college campuses and other circumstances that are kind of walled off from the real world, like BuzzFeed offices. And that it's completely unsuitable for living in the real world. And eventually the real world pushed back. And that's what happened both in the election and I think in a lot of these culture wars. And so I think if I had to summarize it all, Greg, it's that the underreported story of 2016 is that the right is actually winning the cultural wars.
Wow. That is one that I think even a lot of people on the right didn't necessarily think a very short time ago. But I think you're right. I think we saw a massive backlash in that department, and it doesn't appear that the left is getting that. But maybe that'll redound to Republicans' benefit down the road, because people just got fed up. The absurdity has gone too wide and too fast, I think, for many people. And then people finally woke up because it started to actually affect them. And they don't like being told what to think, and they don't like being told what to say. So I'm going to go away from politics for my most underreported story of the year. Jim, one of the things that the media love to do is cover weather. They loved Hurricane Matthew. They were all up the East Coast. They love blizzards if it affects them. If there's 4 inches happening in New York, that is a crisis. If there's 2 feet happening out in the heartland somewhere, no big deal. Hurricane Katrina, of course, got weeks and months of coverage, and that was rightly so. But there was a massive, massive flood in Louisiana in August. And I'm looking at some of the numbers here. According to the governor's office, over 60,000 houses were damaged, 30,000 people rescued. A private analysis from a guy who holds a PhD from LSU suggests that as many as 188,000 occupied houses and over 500,000 people were affected in some way or another by the flood. And the media just didn't care. This was early August, which means Congress is out of town. Obama was on vacation, and he got a little bit of flack from Republicans for not going down there or even issuing a statement from Martha's Vineyard. And he got a free pass from the media for doing it. The media basically spent very little time down there. When Trump took his plane down there to call attention to the problem and to at least donate some things, as I recall, that he and his associates had paid for. Most of the coverage was about whether Trump was just an opportunist, not about the suffering that the people were going through. It wasn't around New Orleans. There's a Democratic governor in Louisiana. There's a Democratic president, so there was nobody to blame. And so there wasn't a political angle, and there wasn't necessarily a big city angle where the media itself was affected. And that shows a bias by omission from the media that is not only true in this story, but we see it quite a few other times as well.
That is a really good example there, Greg. And I think, yes, you know, the biases of the media are not merely political or ideological. Sometimes it is a bias towards drama. Sometimes it is a bias towards conflict. Sometimes it is a bias towards visually interesting stories. But sometimes it's a matter of just sheer geography, that out of sight, out of mind. And for both those folks, and I think you probably could also the wildfires in Tennessee, almost any disaster that is not front and center in the, you know, West Coast or Acela corridor, it's very easy for the media to kind of give that, you know, page A27 coverage. And of course, everyone's chuckling at me now with my expectation that there are more than 27 pages in the A section of their local newspaper.
If they had 27 pages, they probably still wouldn't have gotten much coverage, because I'm sure Trump tweeted something during that stretch. Yeah. So, all right, Jim, there was a lot of bad stuff that happened in 2016. What's the best story of 2016?
Okay, I'm stepping away entirely from the realm of politics, getting something that's not quite personal, but it started personal. Readers of the Morning Jolt know that my wife and I were friends with Cindy Stoll, who was kind of came to everybody's attention. She passed away in early December. It was a week before she taped appearance on Jeopardy. She had wanted to do this her whole life. She competed, you know, took the test several times, hadn't quite made it. Most recent time she applied, she said, "I've been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I've got X number of months left." I think she was at 6 months at that point. That's what the doctors say. None of these things are guaranteed. If you take a pass on me now, there may not be a next time for me to appear on the show. So they had her on. And we obviously were deeply saddened to see Cindy go. It is terrible when somebody your age passes away. 41 years is far too little to go through in this life. And then, of course, the you know, Jeopardy issued a statement pointing out that, you know, she had passed away before her airing. And it went from a sad to a very surreal story to see every place from USA Today to Us Weekly to People to Cosmo suddenly doing these stories on Cindy, almost all of which were just rewritten versions of the Jeopardy statement and one or two Twitter posts from her boyfriend Jason. And I processed a lot of emotions as I watched the full power of the media's laziness on display on a story that I knew the kind of the full story of, and which it kind of turned into this, oh, isn't she sad, watching my friend turn into a human interest story. And then Cindy went on this tear on Jeopardy. And she won the first night. Like, oh, isn't that a nice story? And then she won the second night. And then she won the third night. And she just went on this winning tear. And it stopped being a story about, oh, isn't that sad? And it turned into a story of, oh, isn't that amazing that she is loaded up on painkillers, that she's running a fever that I think turned out to be a blood infection, you know, dealing with everything going through her mind and everything going through her body at that time. And she went out and she kicked the butt of a six-time winner, no offense to that fine person, and many other very smart competitors. And she went out and, you know, night after night, she did an amazing job. And I think she'll probably be remembered as probably one of the greatest Jeopardy players of all time. So if you have to say goodbye to someone special, watching them become something of a legend in their final couple of months on this earth is a pretty good way to do it. So that's what I'm going to remember a good portion of 2016 for. And I think added a nice little inspirational note to the end of what is a long and exhausting and for many people depressing year. Look, if Cindy could do that, what excuse do you have for not doing something extraordinary today?
Truly inspirational story. And as you pointed out, the media could have done a much better job of filling in a more full picture of her life. I know that her boyfriend did appear on CNN towards the end of the year while the streak was going on, and he got to talk about her a little bit more. So thankfully, as you mentioned, people not only inspired, but as a result of her continuing to win, didn't just know that she won, but got to learn a little bit more about her as well. And Jim wrote a very nice piece about Cindy on in the Morning Jolt before we even knew what this streak would be when she actually passed away in December. So, Jim, I'm going to end with an inspirational one, but I've actually got kind of a double-headed one here. It's been pretty bleak, obviously, since 08, and it's hard not being on top for that long of a time. And while there was certainly some good years and positive developments along the way, it's overall been a fairly rough stretch. So something always seeming to get in the way of achieving what we were hoping to achieve. And with each disappointment, 08 just seemed longer and longer ago. But that changed in 2016. Finally, for the first time in many years, everything really unexpectedly came together. And even though by the time early November rolled around, things still didn't look like they would actually work out, what seemed to be impossible finally happened. Yes, the Chicago Cubs are World Series champions.
That is a great choice, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you. That is my first part. As far as also in 2016, obviously a very divisive year. There's not a lot that could bring America together. But for a couple of weeks in Rio, for all the problems with the water and the security and Ryan Lochte and the security agents and a bunch of other things, green water in the diving pool and all sorts of other things, the American team kicked butt. They dominated the pool. They did very well on the track. They did very well on the courts and so many other sports. They greatly exceeded expectations. They rocked the total medal count. They rocked the gold medal count. And people who won were Americans. They weren't hyphenated Americans, although some media probably tried to do that. People fell in love with the gymnastics teams and Simone Biles and Michael Phelps with his swan song and so many other people whose stories just came out. And fortunately, there weren't too many of the sappy stories that went along with it. But we just got to see great achievement and people rewarded based on merit and getting the job done. And America was number one by a mile. So in a year where Americans didn't agree on a lot, hopefully we can agree that America comported itself and did very, very well at the Olympic Games.
That is another great choice, Greg. And yeah, you know, we should point out that even, you know, you and I, a good portion of the fun of this podcast is a little bit of perhaps a jaundiced eye that you and I should probably have checked out. you know, a little bit of cynicism, a little bit of pointing out the things that don't work out the way they do. But there are cases of genuine human achievement, people who can be proud of, people who you can think of as putting forth heroic efforts. And so this was a good year for, you know, it was a bumper crop year in a lot of categories, but didn't lack for heroism either.
Fantastic conclusion to our conversation today. But don't forget to join us on Monday, because then we will reveal our individual choices for Person of the Year, Turncoat of the Year, and offer our New Year's resolutions for 2017. So party, but don't party too hard that you can't ditch the hangover by Monday. Really, by Monday, you should be okay. Jim, enjoy your New Year's celebration, and we'll talk to you on Monday as well.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Happy New Year, everyone.